Today is August 26, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. Today I'm interviewing Mike Burton about his experiences in the Mexico City Olympics in 1968. Mike, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Yeah, I was born on July 3rd, 1947 in Des Moines, Iowa.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up, we moved to California when I was about a year old, and I grew up in the Sacramento area, primarily North Highlands and Carmichael. And I graduated high school from El Camino High School.
How are you first introduced to swimming as a competitive sport?
There was a little, they called it a country club, but really it was just a pool and a tennis court built less than a mile away from our home, and they sold memberships, and my parents bought one. And after about the first year or so, they started, you know, it was just a summer pool. They didn't have a heater or anything. They started a summer league swimming team, and I was about 8 years old. And I had learned to swim, so I started out on that team, and I was my brother and I both swam, and you know, we spent every summer, about 6 weeks was it was all the season lasted. We spent every summer swimming on the team, and then during one particular summer, I was about 14 years old. My father decided that he would enter me in an AAU meet in Redding, California, which is about 3 hours from our home. And so we went up there, and I swam in that meet and did pretty well. And some parents from the Arden Hill Swimming and Tennis Club called my parents and. Because they were looking for a 14 and under backstroker. And they were interested if I wanted to try out for the Arden Hills team, which was at that time and pretty much from then on the biggest and best team in the region. And so we ended up going over there for a tryout. And Sherm Chivor, my swim coach, and also the owner of the club, offered my brother and I a junior membership in the program, and that's how we got started in the real competitive part of swimming, because that was a year-round training and, training 6 days a week, and, you know, and then later on it became seven.
Yeah.
But that's how I got my start.
So I read somewhere that you had a bicycle accident and that you had also played other sports. As well.
I'm obviously a competitive person, so I like sports. I played 4 years of Little League Baseball. I wasn't a very good baseball player. I couldn't hit. I could do everything else, but I could not hit the ball. I wanted to play football in the worst way, but when I was 13 years old, we were playing basketball after school in the fall, and on the way home, we doubled up on our bicycles. I was on the handlebars of my bicycle with my friend John Brush giving me a ride, and we had a head-on collision with a large furniture truck the collision dislocated my right hip and tore the ligaments in my right knee, which pretty much kept me out of football and a lot of the other sports from then on. I did run one season of cross country when I was a sophomore in high school, but then swimming became, my number one love and desire from then on. So I didn't run cross country anymore. All I did was swim.
So did you have to have surgery at the time of the accident?
Yep, I was in the hospital for 8 weeks. The first thing they did was set the hip, And I was in traction for 6 weeks with a sandbag over the end of the bed, you know. And that was, that was an awful time. Because I couldn't turn over. I was on my back the whole time. And so when traction was over, that's when they went in and operated on the knee and to sew up those torn ligaments. And when I came out of surgery, I had a cast from my crotch down to my toes, and the cast was bent at about 45-degree angle. And the first night, I remember I called the nurse in, and I said, "Could you help me turn over on my stomach?" And she said, "Well, sure." And so we flipped over, and she propped pillows around my leg so it would stay upright, you know. And it was so funny. I wasn't there 5 minutes. I was so uncomfortable. I had to call her back and flip me back over on my back. It was, you know, after being 6 weeks on my back, all I wanted to do is lay on my stomach. Well, that didn't work too well.
So I was just going to ask you to summarize your biggest accomplishments in swimming leading up to the 1968 trials.
Oh, boy. Well, probably, setting my first world record in the 1500 in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1966 was right up there as a big accomplishment. And then in 1967 in Dallas, Texas, at SMU, I won the High Point Award for the men at the national championships that year. I took first in the 1650. I think I won the 500 and took third in the 200 fly, or second in the 200 fly, something like that. I can't remember, but anyway, I won the High Point Award, which I'd never done up to that time before. And then, the trials were the next year. So,
can you describe the Olympic trials? What was the process and, you know, any challenges or problems that you might have encountered?
Well, the Olympic trials for the 68 team were held in Long Beach, California, which they are now, I guess at the present time, tearing down the pool because it's so old. But it was state-of-the-art at the time. It was indoors. It was built right on the beach in Long Beach, California. And if you stepped out the west side of the building, you stepped onto the beach, right into the sand. And the ceiling was very, very high because they had a 10-meter tower in it, and a diving tower, of course. And I don't know, every 12, 15 feet, there was a huge square in the ceiling that was glass, and they could open that up to let air in when it was real warm and whatnot. And that was kind of a very cool feature, because when I was swimming my 1500, I remembered that I was, you could see the squares of sunlight on the bottom of the pool as I was swimming. And so I was trying to speed up in the shadows to get to the next sunlight during my race. That was going through my head. Why? I have no idea, but it was. And, but you know, at the Olympic trials, you had to be in the top three in your event to make the team. And, my first event I made the team in was the 400 meter freestyle, which I won, and just missed breaking the world record. And then the 200 fly, I placed, I don't know, fifth or sixth in the 200 butterfly. The 200 freestyle, I probably got ninth. And then for the 1500 meter freestyle, you have to swim your event twice, preliminaries and finals, which is difficult in the 1500 because, you know, they do them at, you know, a day apart. You swim on, say, Saturday for the preliminaries, Sunday for the finals. And if you give too much on in the preliminaries, then you don't have enough left for the finals to do well. So you have to be a little cagey about how you qualified. And I qualified first anyway. And the day of the finals, I remember I was in my hotel room and my fiance was there with me and my roommate, John Ferris, who was also on the 68 Olympic team, was there. And, you know, the TV was on and I'm in my sweats and I'm dressed, ready to go to the finals. And I was going through the race in my mind and, you know, how I was going to swim it and, you know, what I was going to believe the outcome was going to be. And I just blurted out that I'm going to go 16:08 tonight. And my future bride said, "That's impossible." And Johnny Ferris, you know, just grabbed himself and started laughing, you know, because what I predicted was 20 seconds under the world record.
At the time,
the world record was 16:28. And I predicted that I was going to go about 16:08.
Wow.
And when I finished the race, my time was 16:08.5. So I predicted what I was going to swim and swam it, which, and I ended up winning the race by about 25 meters.
Oh, wow. And so that set a new world record as well?
Yes.
That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah, that was fun. That was really fun. Because when I went over to the pool to warm up for the finals, Mike Hastings, who later went on to, was our assistant coach to Sherm, who went on later to coach John Neighbor and Summer Sanders and people like that, you know, he was giving me my warm-up hundreds, my pace work and stuff, and he said, you know, Mike, I think you should slow down a little bit because these are really kind of fast. And I looked up at him, I said, nope, they're just right. I'm going to go 16:08 tonight, so this feels good. I'm ready to go. And he looks at me and he goes, if you go 16:08 tonight, I'll take you and Linda out to dinner after the meet. And I said, you're on. So we went. I think we went to the Chart House there in Long Beach after the meet. So and just had a great dinner and a lot of fun.
Nice. So, Mike, how did your friends and family react to finding out that you had made the Olympic team?
No, you know, my parents were extremely proud and very excited. And, of course, my brother and my sister both called and wished me well in the Olympics. None of them were at the trials. My parents... both worked very hard for a living. We did not, you know, have a lot of money as I was growing up, so everything was kind of a struggle. In fact, for my first national championships when I was 16 years old in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, my parents actually borrowed money to send me to the nationals. And, you know, I was the only swimmer that Sherm had at those nationals in Bartlesville that spring, and... every time he saw me in line, because we ate in the Phillips 66 cafeteria there, every time he saw me in line, he'd yell at the cashier, said, "I'm paying for his."
Oh.
Yeah, so he took good care of me. He was a great, great coach, great friend, and, you know, just a great man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was, you know, everybody was very excited. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, none of them were also going to be good down in Mexico City either, so... It was really fun. It was great.
So none of your family were able to make it to the games?
Nope.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was your coach there at all?
Oh, yeah. He was the head women's coach.
Oh, okay, okay.
And again in 72.
Ah.
So, yeah, so he was always there. And of course, you know... You know, the coaches, you know, respect the right of the Olympic coaches to coach the athletes. And Don Gambrell, who was the assistant coach both in Mexico City and in Munich, was the coach at Long Beach State at the time during those two Olympic Games. And he, you know, tremendous, tremendous coach. I mean, he, and a good friend. And he, and I don't know, he's a great sprint coach, he's a great distance coach, but he was put in charge of the distance swimmers at both Olympic Games. So I got to work with Don, you know, in Mexico and also in Munich. And, you know, he took really good care of us. And, of course, you know, he would, I mean, he's a very, very smart, intelligent guy. He would talk to Sherm about what Sherm wanted me to do, you know, and then, you know, he'd talk to me about it, and then we'd get the job done. And, you know, which, you know, got me prepared the way I'd been preparing all my life to go out and, you know, and win the 400 and the 1500 in Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. Describe your training methods and regimen for preparing for Mexico City and maybe specifically for the high altitude.
Okay. Well, you know, it's kind of silly, isn't it? They had the trials in Long Beach right on at sea level, and we're going to be competing at altitude. I mean, they should have had the Olympic trials in Colorado Springs someplace, you know, at 7,000 feet, so we would be, you know, more prepared and better able to see who is actually going to be able to perform at altitude, because, you know, I'd never swum well at altitude. I went to the little, what they called the Little Olympics in 1966 down in Mexico City, and I did horribly. Of course, it was in the fall of 66. I was not in shape because we had just come off the summer of swimming, and I'd taken a break, and, you know, so I wasn't in shape to do anything, so, but anyway, we did go to Colorado Springs for our training camp, which we were there for 40 days, and, you know, the regimen was, you know, 12 practices a week. Anybody who wanted to do could do a 13th practice on Sundays, and, of course, I did all 13 practices. Because I knew that when you're going to be swimming at altitude, you have to be in tremendous shape and you have to be used to the altitude. And one of the things that the coaches arranged for us was they obtained three cabins up a canyon at about 10,000 feet, where the distance guys and the 400 individual medalists and the 200 flyers would drive up this canyon every night, and that's where we slept. We slept at 10,000 feet. We were training at 7,250 feet, and I think Mexico is about 8,000 or so. I can't remember. But, you know, we felt that that helped get us acclimated to the altitude as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I think helped prepare for the Olympic Games, we stayed in Colorado Springs as long as we possibly could and did not go to Mexico until 2 days before the opening ceremonies.
Oh, wow.
And the reason for that is, you know, you have one Olympic pool. And, you know, how many countries have swimmers at the Olympics that, you know, you're trying to get in there and train and everything else? Because, and then, you know, they have pools in the outskirts of town and stuff like that, but, you know, you don't know what they're going to be like when you get there to do your training. So it was, you know, the coaches arranged for us to, you know, use other countries' time, you know, like, you know, a third world country may have two swimmers there, but they get four lanes. So we would grab two of their lanes, and what they would tell the other coaches was, you know, you can ask questions while we're, you know, our swimmers are training. You can ask our coaches questions, so they could learn from our coaches, and that's how we would buy lanes from them, so to speak.
Mm.
And then we didn't have to do that. And some of the pools outside of Mexico were an hour away by bus, so you go there, you know, you travel an hour one way, and by then we're on our taper, so you do your training, which usually lasted about an hour, and then you take an hour back, and that's a big chunk out of your day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it was very important to, train at the Olympic facility itself. Mm-hmm. It was just way more convenient.
So, Mike, when you went down to Mexico City in 67 to participate in the Little Olympics, were you involved in any of the physiological testing that was going on at that time? Any blood draws or, you know?
No.
Okay.
No. No, and that it was 66 that they had them.
Oh, but, sorry, 66.
Yeah, no, I was not involved in any of that at all. And it was just, to me, it was just a swim meet, you know. But I was, I was at school at UCLA and, I don't know, it's just, I was not in shape. And I felt it, too, when I swam the 1500. Because my number one competitor was a kid named Guillermo Echevarria, who at the Santa Clara Invitational International Meet in July of 1968, we went head-to-head in a 1500, and he beat me, and he broke my world record.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so it was his world record I broke at the trials. And and Guillermo's really a great guy. He and I are friends today, and he's just a super, super guy. And he had a really bad car accident, and so, now he works for the Mexican Olympic Committee. But there was so much pressure. They thought he was going to win because he was the world record holder, up until our Olympic trials. And there was so much pressure for him to win the gold medal in the 1500. They had comic books at newsstands showing the story of the 1500, and then at the end, it shows him getting the gold medal and my coach consoling me off to the side.
Oh, my gosh.
And I never did get a hold of one of those. I just heard about it, and I never did find one. But, when he didn't swim really well at all in the 400, and the 1500 he took seventh place, and it was really sad for him because his countrymen actually booed him when he got out of the water. You know how they whistle?
Yeah,
which was really sad, because he just couldn't handle all the pressure.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure. So, Brent, I read somewhere that you were known for your mega mileage style of training. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, when I first started training at Arden Hills, it was the most strenuous thing I'd ever done up to that time. I swimming in a country club league, that's just fun stuff, A workout is not really hard or anything. It's mostly sitting around and then swimming a couple laps. And, I went to Arden Hills and Sherm started on me we were thrown into these sets and, things like that. And it just seemed like the better I got, the more Sherm gave us as far as yardage and things of that nature. And I remember one particular Saturday, don't remember the exact date, of course, but I remember that it was the turning point in my career. We were, a tremendous amount of butterfly that day. We started with a 1650 fly and then went to 1,000 fly and a couple 500s and a bunch of 200s and 100s. And we did about 5,000 yards butterfly. And then we did some other stuff, and we'd been in the water for 2 hours, and usually that was when our workout ended, after 2 hours. And there were some parents sitting on the side of the pool, watching practice, and we all thought, hey, we're going to get out now, we've been here 2 hours. And all of a sudden, Sherm goes, hang on. And everybody starts moaning and groaning, because whenever he says, hang on, what we're going to end up doing, we're in a 25-yard pool, we're going to do a 1650-yard freestyle, which is equivalent to, like, the 1500. And And so he said, when I say go, a fast 66, which is 66 links of the pool. And so he started us, and I don't know what got into me, but all I wanted to do was swim that repeat, get out, and go home. So I went as hard and as fast as I could. And the rest of the guys, the girls included, were just dogging it. They were just going through the motions. And so I was passing people about every 200 yards. And when I finished and got out, I went in the locker room, and I was dressed before anybody else finished their 1650. And I got in the car, and I told my dad, I said, you know, we've got to stop and get me something to eat. Mm-hmm. Because I depleted, you know, all my energy stores. I mean, I was just exhausted. And so we stopped at one of my favorite hamburger places called Lou's. And I had, you know, their biggest hamburger. I had onion rings, fries, and a large milkshake. I had it devoured before we got home. And I walked into my bedroom, laid down on my bed, and I just passed out. I went to sleep. And from then on, I knew that, you know, no matter what Sherm, you know, gave us, I was going to be able to handle it. Because that was absolutely the toughest workout I'd ever been in. And, you know, because there's no way to go butterfly easy. You have to work it to get through it, and all that fly and stuff like that. And, you know, part of what Sherm, you know, his basic premise was over distance. And, you know, at the time, most teams were going like 6,000 yards in a 2-hour practice. Well, we were going 8,000 yards in a 2-hour practice. And, you know, and I think that's what helped me become a distance swimmer. Was just that, you know, constant over distance training. We did 3,000 yard swims, you know, just lots of laps.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you were preparing to go to Mexico City, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. track team?
Oh, yeah. It was in the papers all the time. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, once we arrived in Mexico, there's a fellow I went to high school with. His name's Cleve Livingston. And he was our valedictorian of our high school class, graduating class. And he went to Harvard and started rowing, you know, because he was actually a diver on our high school swimming team. But he made it on the Harvard rowing team, the 8-man boat. And because he was tall and lanky. And so he came in my room one day in the village and said, Mike, we, you know, we'd kind of like your endorsement for this, you know, the black athlete movement and everything else. And I said, Cleve, you know, to me, that has no place in the Olympic Games. It's not about the black athletes. I'm here for one reason, and that's to compete and try to win gold medals. I said, so I'm not going to get involved in that. And, what was really funny is when Tommy Smith and John Carlos, you know, made their demonstration on the award stand after the 200 meters, and they were eventually kicked out of the village, I was on the elevator when they were, you know, had their suitcases and were leaving the village.
Mm.
And one of the other athletes that was with them said, you know, we're all going to walk out with you. And both Smith and Carlos says, no, we've done our thing. What you guys need to do is stay here and get all the gold you can. So it was, but yeah, I mean, it was prevalent. It was going on.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Yep, we heard about them, you know, gunning students down in the streets that were protesting. But the Mexican officials, you know, reasoning behind that is there was nothing that was going to hinder or disturb the Olympic Games. And once they did that, the protests pretty much stopped. And when we were on the buses to go to the opening ceremonies, all along the route to the from the village to the stadium, every 10 yards there was an armed soldier on the side of the road in the bushes and whatnot, making sure that nothing went wrong.
So what were your impressions of Mexico City and its people?
You know, it's hard to say. Being there for the Olympic Games, everything is, you know, you're so focused and zeroed in on your task at hand. And, you know, the bad part was swimming was at the end of the program, you know. So, you know, you had to really be aware of what you were doing, you know, on a day-to-day basis because, you know, and the 1500 was the last day. You know, so, I mean, it was just crazy. So, a lot of that stuff you block out. I liked Mexico City. I think it's a great city. And of course, some of the Mexican athletes, and, you know, Felipe Munoz, people like that, you know, we'd see on a daily basis over at the pool. And, you know, as I said before, Guillermo's just a great guy, really great competitor. He just knuckled under the pressure. But, prior to your event, you know, you have to be focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I was there for, is to swim.
What about the Olympic Village? What did you think of your accommodations there?
I thought they were fine. I mean, it was like a big apartment building, you know. And the problem that I encountered is, you know, the night before the finals of the 1500, you know, you had in the living quarters. I forget what floor we were on, but you have a living room, and then you have bedrooms that go off from the living room, and. And my bedroom door just opened up right onto the living room. Well, there's, you know, a lot of guys that were done swimming by the time, way before I was, you know, done swimming. And so they were staying up late and, you know, partying, things like that. And the night before my race, I had to get up and open the door. I said, you know, guys, I can't sleep with all this noise. You know, can you take it someplace else? And, you know, they did. And I closed the door and went to sleep, so... But, the living quarters were fine. They're very similar to what we had in Munich. So,
mm-hmm.
Probably the biggest problem that, faced athletes in Mexico City was the turista. You know, prior to my 400, which was my first event, my buddy from UCLA, Zach Zorn, who's a sprinter, 100-meter freestyle, he and I wanted to watch the marathon, so we went downtown Mexico City along the marathon route, and, you know, we're down there, and we got a little hungry and noticed there's a shaky pizza parlor. And so we went in and had shared a large pizza with everything except anchovies. And that night, I was up all night with diarrhea and vomiting.
Oh,
and Zach did not get sick. So I don't know if it was the pizza or what, but, I was deathly ill. And I swam my 400-meter freestyle 15 pounds lighter than normal.
Oh, my God!
I'd lost much weight, yeah.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and that was another, I swam the preliminaries just to qualify. So in the finals, I think I was in lane six, which meant I qualified fourth. And prior to the finals, George, I'd done my warm-up and got my rub down and everything from the trainers. And George Haynes, the head coach, came in and said, you know, Mike, how are you feeling? Because everybody's worried about me, you know, because I'd lost so much weight. And I said, well, I don't know, George. I feel kind of tired. And I looked at him. I said, you know, how fast am I going to have to go to win this? And so he went through the list, the Canadian Ralph Hutton, thinks maybe 4:11, and the Frenchman Alain Moscone, who actually got third, Hutton was second, he says probably about 4:12, and then the Australians think 4:13, 4:14 might win it. And I looked at him and I said, oh, that's good. And he said, why? And I said, because I'm going to go 4:09. And when I finished the race, I was 4:09 flat.
So. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, at sea lift, that race, same race as we swam at sea level, I would have been like 3 seconds under the world record. But at altitude, I was like 3 seconds over the world record.
Hmm. At altitude and having just lost 15 pounds.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, other than that one bad experience with the Shakey's pizza, how was the food that you had?
Well, in the village, it was really pretty good. I being an athlete that trained a lot, I ate a lot. And you just had to be kind of careful, with what you ate and so on. So I really don't know why I got sick, but a lot of people just got thrown completely out of their race because they got sick. Like what's his name? He's a doctor now, 200 freestylist for the United States. Anyway, he got sick, and he couldn't make it to the finals. So there was an empty lane in the finals. They didn't even put the alternate in.
Mm. My gosh.
So, yeah. But, the Mexicans are experts on dysentery, because even they get it. So, but I'd say it was not a fun experience.
Mm-mm. Well, Mike, was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close? Anybody that was, one of your best friends there in Mexico City?
Oh, yeah. There were a couple, Don Scholander and John Ferris. John Ferris and I swam at Arden Hills together, so, we knew each other really well. And so he was my roommate. And in Colorado Springs, whenever we were at the Broadmoor and slept, John and I shared a room with Mike Wall and Don Scholander. Don Scholander and Mike Wall were the best of friends. Don stayed at, he was from Lake Oswego, Oregon, and when he moved down to swim with Santa Clara, he lived at Mike Wall's house, so they were really close. And, Don and John and Mike, that's who I hung out with the most.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories of the opening ceremony?
Oh, it was, when you first walk into the stadium and the crowd just goes crazy. I'll tell you, it's a very, very emotional high. You're just, you hardly feel your feet touch the ground, and it's, you're walking in, with the United States team, which is over 325 people, and it's a huge team, and I don't know, it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. With 1968 being kind of the height of the Cold War and Vietnam, Did you feel the effect of the political climate at all on the games or on any interactions with athletes from other countries or from the Soviet bloc?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. One day, I'm just relaxing in my room and, there's a knock on the door, open the door, and there's these two athletes standing there who I did not recognize, and they were from the Soviet Union. And they came in and sat down, and we started talking, and they said, we would like to change gifts for your Levi's. Because in those days, they couldn't get a pair of Levi's in the Soviet Union. Mm. And I said, well, what do you have? And he says, well, we have Russian cigarettes. I said, well, we don't need the dang cigarettes. He says, well, how about Russian vodka? And I said, okay. And so I traded a pair of my Levi's for a bottle of Russian vodka. And I actually, I took it home, gave it to my father. I was 21 in Mexico City, but, I thought, well, this would be a good gift for him, because, you're not going to get true Russian vodka in the United States at that time. But, I took it home and gave it to him.
What did your dad think of that?
He thought it was pretty neat. Mm-hmm. He said it was good stuff, so.
So, I want to talk a little bit about your gold medals and how your competitions went. Can you describe what it felt like to know that you had won and what it felt like when you actually received the gold medals?
Yeah, those two things are really hard to describe. And, in the 400, in my race plan always was to go out fast and try to wear down the competition. And, because if anybody was going to stay with me, they were going to hurt. And when I touched the wall in the 400 and found out that I'd won, it's just exhilarating, the amount of adrenaline that's pumping through your body and how you feel and the excitement and everything else. But, when you get on the award stand and actually, they put that medal around your neck and you feel the tug of the weight of the medal and then the Star Spangled Banner starts playing. Both times I teared up. I was just proud to be an American. I was proud to be there. And I was really glad that it was over and I had actually won, because that's a long time, like between the trials and the actual Olympic Games to be preparing for that, one or two races. And, it's a difficult thing. And then, man, when it happens that you actually do win, the relief is enormous.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It must feel like a huge weight lifted off your shoulders.
Oh, it's gigantic. Yeah, it's it's phenomenal. It's amazing. And of course, when you win a gold medal at the Olympic Games, you sleep in it that first night. And then I gave, I remember both, all three times that I won, I gave the medal to my coach and he put them in a safe deposit box in the village so that they wouldn't, disappear.
Oh, wow. Did that happen to anybody that you know of?
Not that I know of. Okay. But Sherm was always a careful guy. He's a World War II bomber pilot. And he was just always, a careful guy. He took good care of me. Mm-hmm.
So 68 was the first summer games in which they implemented kind of a standardized drug testing program. Do you remember if you were tested at all?
No, I wasn't. Yeah. I think it was a real random thing in Mexico City. In Munich, they tested all the medal winners and one from the event, one other one. So they had four in every one. And so that I remember, but not in Mexico City. The main thing we wanted after our races in Mexico City was oxygen.
Yeah.
And they had, you know, little tanks with masks around that you could, you know, suck some oxygen down after your races, which was really pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because Johnny Ferris, you know, my roommate, who was, he won the bronze in the 200 IM and the 200 fly. Well, during the award ceremony in the 200 IM, which the United States swept with Charlie Hickox winning, Greg Buckingham second, and John third, during the Star Spangled Banner, John's knees buckled and he was fainting. He was passing out, and Charlie quickly tucked his arm underneath John's arm and held him up until the Star Spangled Banner ended, and then they carted him off on a stretcher.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, because it was just a lack of oxygen. He passed out.
Oh, wow. Do you remember hearing anything about the women having to undergo gender verification testing in 68?
You know, yeah, we did. And, you know, and Debbie Meyer, I think, was involved in that. But I don't know to what extent. Sherm was a little upset about it, you know, because she was so good. And I don't know if you've talked to Debbie yet or not, but she's also one I hung out with because she was from Arden Hills, you know, our club team, and we're like brother and sister. Mm. And so, yeah, that was going on. And then, you know, of course, you know, primarily it was, you know, looking at the, you know, the Soviet bloc countries, women in the weight events, you know, the, you know, the discus and the shot put and things like that.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories of the media and journalists and TV cameras there in 68? And did anyone back home see you on TV?
You know, I was never a media child, you know, I mean, the media never really paid much attention to me. So I don't know if I was lucky or what, but, but it was, you know, I mean, the television was there. They didn't interview me after my races. You know, and in fact, Don Scholander, he had finished his last event prior to my 1500. So ABC contracted with Don to be an additional commentator on the 1500 with Murray Rose and Bill Fleming. So, but I, you know, in Munich, they had a big press conference room after your event, but Mexico City, they really didn't have that.
Well, what were some of the most memorable things or events that you got to go to, if you got to go to any besides the marathon in Mexico City?
I can remember three, and, you know, my memory's not really great, but in the 10,000 meter run, the Australian runner, you know, before he finished the race, he stepped off the track into the infield and collapsed. And I looked at the 10,000 meter run kind of like the same distance and intensity as my 1500. So when that, you know, and the guy's famous. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but you can probably look it up in the results from Mexico City. But he actually went in and collapsed on the infield and did not finish the race. And I was sitting in the stands watching, thinking, okay, my 1500 is going to be tough.
Yeah.
and then the second one was Ralph Boston. Mm-hmm. Setting the world record in the long jump. And then, of course, watching Dick Fosbury in the high jump.
Wonderful. Those are some really good ones.
Oh, yeah. I just happened to go to the stadium that day, those days, and saw those three things happen, which was really, mm-hmm. really pretty cool. A lot of fun. And then, you know, of course, you know, I watched all the swimming and cheered my Arden Hills teammates on, you know, John and Debbie and Susie Peterson and Vicky, you know, Vicky King was an alternate and stuff like that. So I, you know, it was fun. I like the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. They're a blast.
What are your memories of the closing ceremony?
Well, you know, Mexico City, the closing ceremonies were quite different. They picked three athletes from each nation to actually march into the stadium. And Debbie was one of our athletes. I don't remember who the other two were. And, you know, Debbie was only, 16 then. And, you know, all the other athletes were forced to be in the stands while, you know, just the three from each nation marched into the stadium. Well, I don't remember, you know, who started it or whatever, but the athletes in the stands wanted to be involved in the closing ceremonies. And so we jumped the fence, and I knocked down a soldier and went out on the infield and, you know, of course found Debbie right away because it was chaos after that. I mean, there were people running everywhere, and I wanted to make sure she wasn't hurt or anything. So I went directly to her side, which, and her parents were in the stands, so they were, and they saw that, and they were glad that I was out there. But, and that's what, to me, the closing ceremony should be, not just a few athletes, but everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because, you know, in Munich, I actually was chosen to carry the flag in the closing ceremonies and led the Americans into the stadium. And then it was just a lot of dancing on the infield and just, you know, a lot of joy,
mm-hmm.
which I think was a great closing ceremonies. And finally, the soldiers in Mexico just gave up on us because, you know, there was too many of us out on the infield anyway. So it turned into a party right there.
That's pretty cool. So what did you do right after the games?
Well, let's see, I'd taken the spring quarter off at UCLA to go to Colorado Springs and train on my own, which was probably the hardest training I'd ever done, because I'd show up at the pool and the workout would be written on the chalkboard that Sherman sent to the swimming coach at the Air Force Academy, and he'd just write it on there and leave, and I just show up and do the workout, and that was really hard. Took a lot of tremendous self-discipline. And then so after the games, you know, I was, you know, out another quarter, the fall quarter at UCLA, because, you know, I didn't get home from the games until the first part of October. And I actually worked at Arden Hills as a groundskeeper. And, you know, before going back to school after January 1st. So from the time I got home until, you know, all through Christmas, everything, Christmas break and everything, I pulled weeds, raked leaves, cut grass, whatever.
Wow. And that was after winning two gold medals.
Yeah. Yeah, but I did, you know, I wanted to take a break from the pool. Didn't want to get in the water. And of course, a lot of my work was being done while the other kids, you know, the younger kids are swimming and everything. And I actually got back in the pool on January 1st.
Oh, wow. So what was the reaction of your friends and family to your homecoming and your medals?
Just pure excitement. I mean, when we got back from Mexico City, they had a parade for all the athletes from Sacramento that were on the Olympic team. You know, they, you know, Cleve in the rowing and, you know, all of the swimmers, of course, and then, there was, you know, a few others as well, but they had a parade through downtown, and we were all in convertibles. My parents got to ride in my convertible with me, and, my sister and brother were there, and it was just, it was a great time. We had a blast. And then I'll tell you how fame is fleeting, you know. Well, because I was out of school for two quarters in a row, my draft board immediately made me 1A.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so because I wasn't in school. And Sherm even called. He knew people on my draft board. He called them up, and he says, he was in the Olympic Games. And they told him, well, the Olympic Games are over now. And they wanted to draft me and send me to Vietnam.
So how did that turn out? I mean, what happened with that?
Okay, when I got back to school, I joined the Navy ROTC.
Okay.
Yeah, and then when it came time, I took double the classes because, you know, you take classes for 2 years, and then they ask you to take a physical. And this is going to kill you. I failed the physical.
Oh, wow.
Because of my my hip and knee. They wouldn't take me.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, I figured, wow, that's amazing. And so then I wasn't in ROTC anymore, and they made me 1A again. And so I joined the Army ROTC and took double classes again. And when I finished, I did not want to go in the service. That's one thing I did not want to do, because I was still I still had the Olympic Games on my mind. I still wanted to go to Munich in 72. And so I was made 1A again, and so Sherm had me go see an orthopedic surgeon in Sacramento. He wrote a letter to my draft board, and I immediately became 1Y, which means, you know, you're not called unless your shores are invaded.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, and then I was out of the service forever then, so it wasn't a problem. I could just train without that hanging over my head.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So can you describe just the most memorable memories, I guess, from Munich, and maybe some of the major comparisons between Munich and Mexico City that you haven't already talked about?
Well, of course, you know, the 1500 meter freestyle, where I actually broke the world record by just 0.3 seconds, because I was the third qualifier on the Olympic team in the 1500 in Chicago at the trials. And here again, the reason I wasn't a media child, Sports Illustrated did not pick me to win a medal at all. Everybody thought that, you know, I was 25 years old, which then was old for a swimmer. Nowadays, because you can get paid for it, they're lasting longer. But, I was 25, and they thought, well, it's nice that Mike's on the team and, you know, everything else. And we actually had tri-captains for the swimming team. I was one, Gary Hall Sr. was one, and my roommate in Munich, Mitch Ivey, was the third one. And so, it was just, you know, it was great to be in Munich. It was great to go through the opening ceremonies. And, you know, they had, which kind of blew me away at the time and still does, they had Olga Connolly carry the flag for the United States in the opening ceremonies.
Mm.
And I don't know if you know Olga Connolly's background, but she is a Czechoslovakian shot putter. And I believe she was on the Czech, no, was she on the Czech team in 68? I don't know. But anyway, she ended up marrying Hal Connolly, who was a hammer thrower for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if she wasn't on the Czech team in Mexico City, she was prior to that in the Olympic Games, because Munich was her fourth Olympics. And so, but she was now a U.S. citizen because she married Hal Connolly and became a U.S. citizen. And because it was her fourth Olympics, they had her carry the flag for the United States.
Oh, wow.
In the Olympic ceremonies, which I don't know. I feel that, you know, yeah, she's an American now, but I felt that, you know, maybe an athlete that had been born and raised in the United States would have been more proper.
It sounds like it was a very politically motivated decision, kind of like a statement.
You know, and you're dealing with, you know, the United States Olympic Committee in that area, you know, and apparently I didn't vote, but apparently, you know, we're supposed to vote for the person to carry the flag, and as I understand it, that's how I got voted to carry the flag in the closing ceremonies. But the funny thing is, when I got home, some of my friends said, you know, Mike, when you came in with the flag, ABC Wide World of Sports said, and leading the American contingent is Olga Connolly, because they thought she was doing it again, you know.
Oh.
But it was me. I mean, it was really cold that night. And so I had, you know, they had given us these top coats as part of our uniform, and I had a hat on, and, you know, I had the flag and everything, and you know, we went around the circle, went to the infield and partied, and then it was time to go. So I walked out, took the flag with me, and it was over.
So,
you know, and then of course the big deal in Munich was Mark, and who was also an Arden Hills teammate of mine, and you know, so that's where all the media went. In fact, after I won in Munich at the press conference, and I don't know if you know the history of the 1500 in Munich, but Rick DeMont actually set the world record in Chicago. And he was 15 at the time, turned 16 in Munich. And excellent swimmer. And but he was an asthmatic, and after he won the 400, he tested positive for ephedrine, and so they disqualified him from the 400, and he had already swum the preliminaries in the 1500, and they disqualified him from that. So that ended up with just Doug Northway, another 16-year-old kid, and myself in the 1500 for the United States, and Doug ended up getting third. But, you know, the Australians thought they had the race in the bag then, because they thought there was no way that, you know, Mike Burton was going to do anything. But I ended up doing my best time and just barely breaking the world record.
And I read that you were the first person to win the 1500 twice in the Olympic Games?
First, yeah. Yeah. And I'm still the only American.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's...
Kieran Perkins from Australia won it in 92 and 96, and he was actually going for a three-peat in Sydney in 2000,
mm-hmm.
but Grant Hackett ended up winning that. And then Vladimir Solnikov from the Soviet Union won it in 1980, which, you know, of course, we boycotted. And then he won it in 88 because the Soviets boycotted 84. And I believe that Vladimir could have been the first three-peat.
Oh, wow.
Because he was an amazing swimmer and a really nice guy. I got to meet him in Sydney in 98. We went over there for a luncheon put on by the Australian Olympic Committee. And they had invited seven of what they thought were the Australians felt were the top 1500 meter freestylists of all time. And of course we were still alive. And, you know, the Australians, swimming is like their national pastime. And they feel like the 1500 is their event. And because, the first guy was, John Conrads, who won the 1500 in Melbourne in 1960 or 1956. And he, you know, he's Australian, of course. And then Murray Rose won it in 1960 in Rome, and he's Australian. And Bobby Windell won it in Tokyo in 1964. And then I won it 68, 72, Vladimir 80, 88. And, of course, Perkins, who's Australian, 92, 96. And then Grant Hackett, at the time, was the current world champion. And they had us all on stage, and they had microphones on us, and there was an MC, and he was asking us questions about our training and, you know, our coaches and all this stuff. And then he said, one last question I want each of you to answer in turn. And he said, what do you believe is the reason for the dramatic drop in the 1500 meter time over the years? And Conrad started, you know, they started with the 1956 first. And he was saying that, he just felt that, everything's better now. And it is, you know, the coaching's better, the training's better, the pools are better, the equipment that you use are better. And Murray Rose echoed what John had said. And then Bobby Windell said, you know, I just have to agree with John and Murray, you know. And so I stood up. And when it was my turn, and, you know, on a really good day, I was 5'9". And I looked out at the crowd, and I gestured to the guys to my left. And I said, if the gentleman to my left will just stand up, I'll show you why the times are faster. And Vladimir's, you know, they're all 6'4 or better. And Vladimir looks like he could play linebacker for a pro football team. He's just a big, strong guy. And, you know, Kieran Perkins is tall and lanky, and so is Grant Hackett. And, you know, you look at these guys' feet, you know, and they all wear a 12 to 14 shoe. I wear an 8.5. And so, of course, the Australians thought that was funny. They just roared, you know. And I said, we are building athletes bigger and stronger. And I think it's even true today. You look at the Olympic trials in 2012, 2008, you know, Michael Phelps, Missy Franklin, you know, all those kids are big and strong.
Yeah, yeah, they are.
And they're talented, and they're hard workers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you got those three things going for you, you're going to be a champion.
So that leads into another question I want to ask. If you could give just one piece of advice to an Olympic hopeful, what would it be?
For a prospect athlete?
Yes, somebody who in swimming, let's say, was hoping to make it to the Olympic Games. What one piece of advice would you give them?
Well, I just tell them, you know, you really have to dream big, and you have to live your dream. You know, I can count probably on one hand the number of practices I missed in a year. And that's, you know, for being sick or for no reason or whatever, you know, just probably five practices at the most. And, you know, the practice time was always a priority over everything else. When I was in high school, even, you know, on Fridays, you know, there would be a dance at school or something else. Well, I would show up late because I was training. But I'd go, you know, I wouldn't say, well, I can't go because I'm training, you know. But I would just show up late rather than, you know, get out of practice early or not go at all. And, you know, dream big and train hard. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the guys you're going to be competing against are going to dream big and train hard.
So, Mike, when after 72, when and why did you change or reduce your level of involvement in competitive swimming?
Well, as far as an athlete,
Yes.
I was old. I was also, to be honest, going into Munich, I was really at what I would consider the twilight of my career. The training had become, more and more difficult. Kind of like where I think Michael Phelps is today. He keeps telling his mother he does not want to go to Rio, but he'll buy her a ticket if she wants to go. And he'll probably go and watch. But they keep teasing everybody. Like at the recent World Championships, they keep asking all Ryan Lochte, you think Michael's going to come back? And he says, oh, I think he misses it. I think he's going to come back. Yeah, you miss the glory. You miss the actual racing. But the day in and day out regimen of training really wears on you. And, leading up to Munich, I was getting to that point, and I was having a very, very difficult time. And so, after Munich, I went into coaching, and I coached for about 30 years on the national level. And that was really fun and really rewarding. So I had a great time.
Where did you
But I
coach?
knew that my race in Munich was my last one.
Where did you coach, Mike?
Oh, I coached a number of places. I started out, my first coaching job was at the Multnomah Athletic Club in Portland, Oregon. And then from there, I coached BYU and actually coached BYU to their first WAC conference championship in the history of the school. And then from there, I went to Philadelphia and coached the Philadelphia Aquatic Club. And then I went out to Arizona in Glendale and coached the Glendale Swimming Gauchos. And then, believe it or not, I went back to my hometown after that, Des Moines, Iowa, and coached the Des Moines Swimming Federation. And then from there, I went to Olympia, Washington, and coached the Evergreen Swim Club. And then when we moved here to Billings, Montana, I coached at the YMCA for a while. And now I'm retired.
So you've had a very long coaching career.
Oh, yeah. And, during most of those years, at least up until the time I went to Olympia, I was also involved in the legislative part of competitive swimming and going to the national conventions and being a representative from our local swimming committees and being on committees on the national level. I was on the rules committee for like 6 years. Of course, I was also on the United States Olympic Swimming Committee for a number of years. And so, I was involved that way, but not competitively.
But you still stayed involved in the sport. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about your reflections on amateurism then as it was in 68 and 72, and what it is today.
Well, I'll tell you, Avery Brundage is rolling in his grave right now, because he was the head of the IOC for all the years I was competing, and he was a staunch supporter of amateurism. And if he knew what was going on today, he would just be beside himself. But it's a sign of the times. Call it progress, whatever. I feel I was born like 20 years too early. I think it's, we're seeing some really phenomenal feats of athletic ability because of the fact that athletes can now support themselves, maybe even a family, with their endorsements and whatnot that they get from being a competitor, where in the past we could get zero. You know, at best, you know, they could pay our expenses to a meet or something, but that's it.
Mm.
It's just, you know, it's something that I think was going to come. It was just a matter of time.
Right, right. Well, what for you has been the most meaningful part of being a participant in the Olympic Games and in the Olympic movement?
Oh, as far as I'm concerned, it's being a part of history. You know, even with the change from the amateur part to the more professional part, you know, the Olympics still has that aura of, you know, the people that have gone before and, you know, maybe have set milestones in their era and so on and so forth. I think, you know, that's the mystique of the Olympic Games for me. I've even read books on the history of the Olympic Games and so on and so forth. And what was really, really kind of fun for me was when we went to Australia in 98 for that luncheon, the Australian Olympic Committee gave me a book entitled Australians in the Olympic Games. And I've read that whole book, and it's just fantastic. You know, the stuff that, you know, went on and past Olympic Games and so on. So I think, you know, just being a part of history is really a neat feeling for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So what impact has your involvement in the Olympic movement had on your life? In other words, any benefits or drawbacks of having been an Olympian?
Oh, well, I don't think, you know, there's been, you know, the only benefit happens about every 4 years. You know, somebody, you know, the Olympics come up and somebody finds out that I'm an Olympian. And so they call the newspaper or the TV stand. They come out and, you know, it's like, okay, let's pull this guy out of the closet, dust him off. Okay, here's an Olympic champion. And they do a story. But in between time, you know, it just doesn't happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll tell you, in this country, I've never been stopped on the street in a restaurant where some complete stranger has come over and asked me for my autograph. Ever. And in other countries, that's happened to me.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. And the reason, you know, after Munich, you know, I thought, you know, maybe I can do some endorsements, you know. And so I when I was living in Philadelphia, I went to New York City, and I had appointments at five agencies. And one was the William Morris Agency, who was handling Mark at the time. And, you know, none of them were interested. And the last guy I talked to, he said, you know, Mike, can I be honest with you? And I said, you know, I wish you would. It'd be great. And he said, do you hit home runs? I said, no. He said, do you score touchdowns? I said, no. He said, do you make baskets? I said, no. He said, how many gold medals did you win? I said, I won three. He says, that's not seven, is it? I said, no. He said, the public won't buy you. You know, but nowadays they probably would, because, you know, even one gold medal is, you know, really revered, where, you know, back in those days when every, you know, there was one or two athletes out of each Olympic Games that made anything off endorsements. Debbie Meyer in Mexico City, Mark Spitz in Munich, you know, Bruce Jenner, you know. Other than that, it just doesn't happen, mm-hmm. or didn't happen at the time. I pretty much live in obscurity here. I mean, all my friends know I'm an Olympic champion and whatnot, you know, my friends in town here. But, you know, for the most part, I can walk around town and nobody recognizes me because, you know, they don't know who I am. And I do have a license plate that says Three Golds on it.
And do people
on my
ask?
Truck and once in a while they'll ask, you know, and when Carol and I lived in an apartment one time, this one lady kept calling me Mr. Gold because we had one of Carol's sons staying with us at the time. And so there was three of us in, you know, in our apartment there. And so she thought we were the Golds.
That's really funny. So, Mike, in your opinion, what is the legacy of the 1968 team, if you had to guess or come up with what the legacy, in your opinion, what it would be? What do you think it would be?
Boy, I'll tell you, you know, I don't know if I had the misfortune or the opportunity to compete in two of the most controversial Olympic Games ever. You know, Mexico City with the almost black boycott, Munich with the terrorist attack. You know, I mean, I'd have to say, you know, the threat of the black boycott by the black athletes was probably immense. You know, Mexico City, you know, had its obstacles for the athlete, which were the dysentery and the altitude. But, you know, as far as their students protesting and stuff like that, none of that happened while we were there. They squelched that immediately before, you know, anybody had gotten there. And Carlos and Smith did on the award stand, you know, I mean, you go to California State University at San Jose, and they've got a mosaic of that, of them on the podium in the middle of campus there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they call that Track City, and you know, so that's got to be way up there. You know, there were lots of great performances by a lot of great athletes at Mexico. Just another thing that happened to me that is, interesting as far as media and say fame are concerned is, you know, Bill Toomey won the gold medal for the decathlon in Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the blue sport coat guys in the AAU didn't feel that would be enough for him to win the Sullivan Award. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's given to the what they consider the greatest amateur athlete for that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the AAU at that time arranged for Toomey to do a time trial at UCLA after the Olympic Games and to try to break the world record. And I was on campus that day he was doing it. So I went over and watched and, you know, they had guys who were like 80 years old holding the stopwatches and doing the timing and the judging and everything else. And he ended up breaking the world record, and he ended up winning the Sullivan Award that year. And it was a phone-in nomination, which were against the rules at that time. And guess who was second in the Sullivan Award?
Mark Spitz?
Nope, I was.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just feel that was all a setup, you know? So that was a political deal.
That is very interesting. Well, congratulations on your nomination. That's quite something.
Yeah, I actually was runner-up twice.
Wow, that's really incredible. Well, is there anything else before we close the interview? Anything else that you would like to tell us about?
No, I think we covered Mexico City. That's it was a fantastic time in my life. It was, you know, I wouldn't change a thing, even getting sick. I heard from a friend of mine who's a triathlete, and you know, he trains at the Y, and he says, "Mike, I got to tell you this." He said, "I was online the other day, and they were discussing mental preparedness and stuff like that." And he says, all of a sudden, this bleep comes in from Gary Hall Sr. And what he said was, he said, you know, the guy that I knew who was always prepared for his races was Mike Burton.
Mm.
He says, Mike Burton never had a bad race. He was always mentally prepared. And, just like being sick and everything, I still had the mental capacity to go out and do what I had to do to swim my event and win it.
Mm-hmm.
And that mental preparedness, I had a knack for it. And, you know, I just had I think I have a torn rotator cuff, my right shoulder. And so I went for an MRI on Friday. And, they put you in there and they give you some earphones for music and whatnot. And being in that one position for an hour, my shoulder started throbbing. And so I squeezed the bulb to get them to pay attention to me. And they say, "What's going on?" I said, "I need to take a break because my shoulder's killing me." And so they said, "Okay." And they stopped and they pulled me out from the tube, you know. And I pulled my shoulder out of that cuff that they had around it to immobilize it. And I put it above my head and they looked at me with wide eyes. They said, "Most of our patients can't move their shoulder above their, you know, move their arm above their head like that." And I said, "Well, that's where I'm comfortable." I said, "But laying down like that, my shoulder just started killing me." And I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was like a 12. And they said, "Well, you know, shoulders are the hardest." And I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" They said, "Well, we don't like to tell people because then they give up too easily." And I said, "Well, I'm the other way around. If you tell me, I can prepare."
Mm.
You know, and I could have mentally prepared for that because I had no idea it was going to hurt. I was just going to get an MRI on my shoulder.
Right.
You know, but, you know, had I known ahead of time, I could have mentally prepared for it. I was, even as it was going on, I made 45 minutes of the MRI. And, you know, about 30 of that was in immense pain. I could have, you know, I was trying to block it out as I went, but I didn't have time to prepare for it, so.
Well, tell me a little bit about what your mental preparation process is and how that works for you to be able to succeed.
Well, you know, as far as my races are concerned, when I was getting ready for a race, the number one thing I would zero in on in my mind was what kind of pace I was going to hold throughout the race, you know, as far as, what was going to be my time per 100 meters, because I did a lot of broken 1500s, a lot of broken 1650s and 3000s and stuff in practice, where I would do 2100s with 3 seconds rest and try to hold a certain pace. And so, you know, once I got that down, I would remember in my mind what that felt like doing that in practice. And then, you know, I'd visualize myself doing that in the actual race. And for the most part, it worked out where I was able to, you know, repeat what I had done in practice in the race. And, you know, for example, in Mexico City, and I only varied a few tenths of a second, but my time per 100 meters in Mexico City was 107. And in Munich, the day before my 1500, Don comes to me and says, "Sherm wants you to go 15-100s, 3 seconds rest." And I said, "Well, let's just do 10. And that's that part of that old age thing. I said, "Let's do 10 and tell Sherm we did 15. And Don says, "Okay." So I'm doing these hundreds in Munich, and I'm going 102s, 103s, which would put me under the world record. And by the time I finished the 10 100s, there was a crowd of about 50 people around the end of my lane where Don was giving me the times and I was pushing off. And I knew at that point that I was going to be able to hold about 103s in my race. And, you know, I even told my wife at the time that, you know, I'm going to go about 1550, but I think the winner's going to be under 1550. Well, at that time, I did not know that Rick DeMond had been disqualified or anything else. And so I felt I had a real shot at winning. And I knew I was going to go somewhere around 1550. So 1552.58 was my final time. And, you know, I prepared for that by doing those hundreds and knowing what that pace felt like.
Mm. That's really interesting. Well, it's obviously your mental preparation, like Gary Hall was saying, it's definitely worked for you, for sure.
It did, yeah. And, you know, in those days, you know, visualization was, you know, like an embryo. People weren't really talking about it. You know, but I, you know, like at the Long Beach Trials in 68, I was just laying on my bed. TV was on. I'm looking at the ceiling, and I was going through my race, you know. And then in my mind, when I hit the wall at the end, that's when I blurted out, "I'm going to go 1608 tonight," which nobody could believe.
Hmm. That is quite an amazing story that you were able to predict and then set records like that. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Well, it's been fun talking to you today. Is there anything else you can think of that you'd like to get on the record?
No, if there is, Desiree, I'll give you a call.
Okay, definitely. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being so very generous with your time and your memories. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.